crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtegal. We are here in Jerusalem in our office, and I have a special guest with me, archaeologist and graduate of Herbert W. Armstrong College, Christopher Eames. If you've been to the website, you will notice his name on many of the archaeological and history-related articles. He's also worked on Dr. Ilat Mazar's excavations for 3 seasons on the Ophel. He was a regular digger back in 2012. And then his native talents and drive were observed, and he came back in 2013 as an assistant area supervisor, where he learned the ropes of managing the field and also systematic documentation of an archaeological site. Now, this past season, earlier this year, for 10 weeks from January through March, he learned this rope so well that he replaced me as area supervisor over what we have affectionately called the cave. Christopher Eames, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So it is a pretty good life you have here. You're working as a student. Well, you're a student in the United States, and while you're a student, you came to Israel, worked on an archaeological dig for 5 or 6 months, and then you came back the next year. I think you weren't graduate. You weren't graduated at that point. You're still a student, and then you were area supervisor assistant, and then you ended up moving to England and working for our college over there on our campus at Edstone, just south of Birmingham, just north of Stratford-upon-Avon. And now this past year, you're back in Israel, now supervisor, back on the Ophel, most important spot in the world.
That's right.
And you're digging again. And between the end of the dig and now, and it's been a couple months, you have become an assistant archaeological exhibit curator as well. Mr. Eames here was responsible for a lot of the research behind much of the information that you'll read about in the brochure if you've toured the exhibit back in Oklahoma. He was responsible for a lot of the original research. He also tried his hand at a bit of clay work. It was really difficult for us to get a number of replicas of some important artifacts that we wanted to display. And so in order to do that, to make sure that we had some replicas, Chris actually went down and bought some clay and tried his hand at it. And they turned out phenomenally well. One of the Antiquities Authority curators that came over to help us install the artifacts was pretty impressed by your work on that. So we've got a man of many talents right here with us. Right now, he's back in Jerusalem. He doesn't live here. He lives over in England, but he's here in Jerusalem for a few weeks to finish up some work with Dr. Ilat Mazar at Hebrew University. So he goes there each day and works with Dr. Mazar, which is an honor. And then he comes back we're actually recording this in our office, which is also doubles as our apartment here. It's a rather large apartment that we have for when a lot of the students are here, but we're in here, and this is where he is staying as well in this apartment. So I get to see a lot of Chris. But Chris, I would like to talk about this work that you're doing right now with Dr. Mazar at the university. It's kind of it's not in the field, so it could be seen as not that exciting. But maybe just tell us about what you're doing. What's your day like?
Okay, sure. Thanks again for having me, and thanks for the flattering intro. It's great to be here in Israel. And I will say it's as you've just gone through and described some of the things that I've had the chance of doing here, it's been a real blessing, real privilege to be able to travel the world like this and spend time in Israel. It's just the most amazing place in the world, just the history coming alive. And we saw that obviously with our excavations that we did in the past that you described. We saw that with the exhibit that we helped to set up for. A lot of details that were coming through from the biblical record, from the archaeological record, which backs up the biblical record, and then from the some further secular documents from the archaeological record that helps really expound on the biblical story there. But again, an amazing privilege to be here. And as you said, I'm working with Dr. Elat Mazar at the moment. So obviously it's a Sunday to Thursday job over here in Israel, weekends obviously being on Friday and Saturday, so on Shabbat. So it's a great honor to work with such a prestigious archaeologist like Dr. Mazar. And so I go in each day to her office at the Hebrew University, and she assigns me a certain task to do for that day. Lately, I've been working through the stratigraphy for the cave. Now, a lot of the aura of archaeology is just the real excitement of finding stuff underground. You see a patch of earth, you don't know what on earth could be under there, and there's this real
what
excitement.
What in earth could be under there?
Right, exactly. And so you just attack that earth with the pickaxe, whatever you have, looking forward to just amazing discoveries. And a lot of people see the end of the excavation as the end of the work, but really it's just the very tip of the iceberg. It's just the start of all the hard work that actually gets done in the university. And excavation really is only a small part of archaeology. And you have a lot of archaeologists that actually die before their finds and discoveries actually get properly processed. And that's the case with Dr. Benjamin Mazar. He left a lot of finds, a lot of discoveries that weren't fully documented. So what Elat Mazar is doing is going through those discoveries from the Big Dig, from those early digs in the 60s and 70s, and one of her assistants is actually working through some of that material right now, fully documenting it. So there's a lot of research that goes into the things that were found on the excavation.
I would say as well that kind of does not necessarily separate her, because there are a number of other archaeologists that do that focus so much on the publication of their excavations. But there are many that don't. There are many that, as you said, even with Benjamin Mazar, I mean, he was getting on with age, so there's probably more of an excuse there. But there's others that spend so much time digging, and then they don't produce anything at the end, so nobody has a good understanding of what they found or what they didn't find. And so Dr. Mazar puts a high premium on going to town in the off season to get the final reports done and completed. To I think that's very much to her credit. It's a difficult task. It's one that it does take a lot of time and energy, and a lot of people don't have the energy to do it. But
exactly,
she does.
Right,
and she's not lacking in that area.
Yeah, for sure. She's actually known among her fellow archaeologists for just producing such a high quantity of publications. She does spend a decent amount of time in the field. She does do a decent amount of excavating. But really, when we're in the off season, as you say, she really hits those that office work, the research hard, and really publishes quite a lot of material. So she's quite special in that way. And so what she's got us working on at the moment, or me in particular, she's got a few assistants at the office working on various things. One of the things she's got me working on, obviously, is processing finds and discoveries from the cave. As you mentioned, we did the main body of excavation of the Ophel cave in 2018 this year, and then partly in 2013. So we have quite a lot of information to work with that we discovered, a lot of discoveries that were made. And so now we're going through all of it piece by piece, locus by locus, building up a stratigraphy of the cave. And so what we'll do for that is basically divide the cave into main sections. Now we're starting off with Hasmonean, because that was the earliest material that we found in the cave, the earliest material buildup.
So that was on
found.
The real bottom.
Right.
Bottom layer of the cave.
Right. The cave itself is plastered on the inside with at least two thick plaster layers, so they may be from either Hasmonean or before, most likely before, for at least the first layer. But that'll all be researched separately. There is a small wing of research that looks into plaster and how to date plaster. It's a very hard thing to attempt to put a date on. So that'll be for other specialists. But what we're doing is looking at the material in the very bottom of the cave, the very bottom buildup of earth, of a lot of sludge material that we had on the very bottom of the cave. Obviously, the cave got quite wet. It did start out as a water cistern, and so there was a lot of water coming into the cave, openings in the ceiling of the cave, so naturally we've got quite a lot of wet material at the bottom. And we did find quite a significant Hasmonean layer at the bottom of the cave.
So what are the dates associated with that?
The dates associated with the Hasmonean material, I believe, is around 167 onwards, or at least for especially when the Maccabeans revolted in Jerusalem and overthrew Jerusalem. And what you had during that time period, of course, Antiochus had been in Jerusalem. The place was absolutely defiled. The prophet Daniel prophesies about this. And so you have the Hasmoneans coming in, and they just purge the place, absolutely clean it out, make it just a blank slate to start again from, purifying the place. And that's what we seem to find in the cave, because the very earliest material is Hasmonean. So maybe there was earlier material in the cave, but perhaps as part of their citywide purges, the Hasmonean dynasty came in and just cleaned out the cave, started afresh. So that's the first earliest material we've got to run with for the cave, a fairly thick Hasmonean layer. And I've just finished that section. Dr. Elat Mazar is currently reviewing that, and she's quite a strict editor in terms of the content and having everything precisely worded. So it's been a little bit of fun, shall we say, working through the edits for that with her. And currently I'm working through the Herodian strata. There are several phases of Herodian construction in the cave.
So now we're about 2,000 years ago,
right.
Starting around 40, I guess, named after Herod, which we do have in the cave, a small period of things related to Herod,
right.
But then also continuing through the Herodian period goes all the way, even though King Herod's dead. It still continues till the Romans take it in 70. Just so people are aware.
Right. And the cave was actually quite difficult to excavate, because it was the accumulation layers at the bottom of the cave showed a general progression of use through the Hasmonean period, through and stopping at some point during the Herodian period, right at the end. It definitely seems to be right at the end that this accumulation layer stopped. So we have a lot of very fine transitional layers, so that can be quite hard to recognize as you're looking down on it. While you're standing on it and excavating it, it can be quite hard to determine that until you see the layers in a section. Say you might cut a section and leave some earth standing.
Big cross-section, like cutting a slice of cake.
Right, and then you can see the layers quite clearly. But when you're just going straight down, it's very hard to see what you've got. But we do have a gradual transition layer. So we've got quite a thick Hasmonean layer. We've got a section of Hordus material. Hordus is referring to Herod. Oftentimes, archaeologists will break down the Herodian period into further smaller layers, and obviously Hordus relates to King Herod and the quite definitive pottery from exactly around his time period. You can really see a transition in the different types of pottery. And then you have the progression right into thick, just definitive Herodian pottery. And then you have those accumulation layers in the cave ending. And this happened...
Which I just think is, before we even get to that, it's kind of interesting if we... You've got a Hasmonean layers, and then you can see the gradual accumulation through these years. It means that the function of this cistern or cave continued, unstopped, it seems, at least through 200 years probably, or something in that kind of range. And then, as you say, it does abruptly end.
Right. Yeah, you have these very closed windows of time where the cave started to be used during the Hasmonean period, or at least restarted use during the Hasmonean period. It didn't show a continuation of Hellenistic material or earlier Persian material. It the material restarted in the Hasmonean period, ended natural accumulation use in the Herodian period. So quite a tight window, not so much tight, but definitive window there of time for the natural use of the cave. And then right at the end, you have this building project that happened in this cave, this really unusual building project which we don't quite understand yet. Which
is why we're doing this, is why you're in the office at the university.
Exactly. When you're in the field, it's amazing. You don't know what you'll find. You make certain token finds all along the way, but you don't really understand what they are for, what they belong to, what kind of story they're telling. And I've actually been getting quite excited at the university the last day or two, just going through the finds and actually finally starting to understand what happened in the cave. And you can really start to put yourselves in the shoes of the Jews that were living in the during that time period, right at the end of the Herodian period, during the time of the Great Revolt. As the Romans were coming in, sweeping into the city, besieging Jerusalem.
Because I think if people remember, during the excavation, one of the big news stories that made the front page of the Jerusalem Post back sometime in late March or early April, I forget, it was late March, was the discovery of just a massive amount of coins from that revolt. Not just coins from the early part of the revolt, but even the fourth year of the revolt into 69 CE. These are just the mass of coins, the proportion of coins from the fourth year. That was extremely rare to find that many in the cave. And, you know, that speaks to this exact period that you're talking about, when there was construction inside a cistern,
right,
that you don't expect to take place. But that's what we have. And you say that it's becoming clearer now.
Right. And obviously, all of these discoveries, as they come out, the full explanation of them will be published in Dr. Mazar's upcoming Ophel report. That'll really detail the cave in full. But like you mentioned, there was that coin hoard that was released from the cave. Actually, we had, I think, around 250 coins.
Wow.
That were found dig wide for both areas. I believe 210 maybe were from the cave, a whole lot of Hasmonean coins. And around,
and it's good for people to know, this is when we're dealing with this era. I mean, we use pottery for dating, but coins are the greatest gift to an archaeologist.
Coins are amazing, and I've been really figuring out that out the last day or two, because you can see the loci, or a locus is the area of earth that you're digging in a certain specific area that has one definition for that area. It's a layer of earth or a mound of stones. That's your locus. So the loci, plural, different loci have had different coins in them, and we can go back into the record now that the preliminary coin analysis is done and say, okay, this is where a year 4 coin came from. This is where a Hasmonean coin.
And that analysis doesn't get done real time on an excavation. And so it's hard to know, as you say, as you're digging, well, what specific era, you know the era, but you might not know you're 5 years later or you're 10 years later, but coins, since they're minted so often, they've got a lot of good features on them that are easily recognizable. If you're a coin genius, now you can finally see those coins and the dates associated with the layers.
Right, exactly. And what we've been learning is that the very latest coins of the revolt, year 3, year 4 in particular, the dispersal of those coins, and that this construction that happened in the cave, after the cave lost its natural use, this final massive construction push happened right in the last days of the siege, right in the last moments during that final year. And obviously the Jews were seeing that it was a losing battle. They were going to have to take drastic measures. The cave would have been a prime hideout area for the Jews as things got really rough in those final weeks and days of the siege. So we see a huge construction push, a couple of terraces built within the cave. We don't fully understand what it was for, and it seems like the construction was cut short. Maybe that's when the Romans broke through. Maybe the Jews didn't have the chance to finish what they had intended to build in the cave. And so, again, that makes it that much more difficult trying to understand what they were trying to do in the cave, what kind of walls or defensive mechanisms they were trying to put in place. But it does give a really amazing, really interesting and deep window into what the Jews went through during that time period.
Yeah, you definitely see the, I mean, we can read Josephus and the historian from that was an eyewitness to this on the outside of the city walls. And he obviously wrote a lot about the suffering that took place in the city and the desperation of the Jews in those final days. And in this cave, we get to witness that with a construction project underground in a cave, as Josephus said they did. That was cut short for some reason. Obviously, we know the siege ended. The Romans broke through. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of get that sense and that picture from it.
For sure. And so, like I say, we've got a lot of work left to do before the publication comes out. But if you can, I'd encourage the listeners to read about any discoveries further that we make and any finds that come out after they've been properly analyzed in the office. As our listeners may know, sometimes it takes a while for finds to come out public, as it did with the Hezekiah Bulla and the Isaiah Bulla. Not saying we've got anything like that.
I don't think he's hinting here.
This time,
he's not hinting.
I'm just speaking generally, but it is just some amazing stuff that happened.
Yeah, that's good to remember, for sure.
For sure. And so so keep on the lookout for Ophel Volume 3. That should be the one that discusses the cave in full, in depth.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for those insights into the more of the process of archaeology. I think I'm guessing it's probably like 10% dig, 90% right. In the office, something like that. And although it's not glamorous, real archaeologists love it. They love getting into these details. Dr. Mazar is one of those for sure. We're going to take a short break now, but please stay around. Chris will be with us after the break, and he's going to talk about the latest article he has written for Watch Jerusalem. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm here still with archaeologist Christopher Eames, area supervisor on the Ophel excavations of Dr. Eilat Mazar, just south of the Temple Mount and just north of the City of David. He's also one of our archaeology writers, one of our main archaeology writers for the Watch Jerusalem site, and he has written a number of series on the site. You may have seen them about the Bible's buried cities. He's also had one on the different kingdoms and empires and peoples. He has just co-written another article. It's entitled, well, it's from the Bible's Buried Cities series, where he goes into the ancient cities in Israel and compares what's been found in archaeology and also the biblical descriptions of those cities. He's written about Megiddo before, Jerusalem, Gezer, Lachish, Jericho, and a bunch more. And the latest one is on Hebron. And so until I moved to Israel, I didn't actually realize how important Hebron is to both Muslims and Jews. And you write here that it's the second holiest site for both of those religions inside the modern state of Israel. Why is Hebron so important?
Well, Hebron is really a foundational city for the Jews. That's well known throughout the Bible. For the Muslims as well, there's a lot of Abrahamic tradition that goes back to Hebron. And of course, Abraham is honored both in the Bible and in the Quran. And so there's a lot of tradition that goes back directly to Abraham and the forefathers, which goes right back to the city. And the Bible actually describes how the early patriarchs were buried in this area, and that traditional site of the tombs during Herod's time, he wanted to be revered by the Jews of his day. So he built a magnificent edifice over that tomb, and later on, well after his death, Islam spread on the scene, and the Muslims turned it into a mosque. So they also venerated the area. Hebron, pronounced Hevron in Hebrew, actually means friend or comrade. And that's because of the Arabic and Hebrew traditions, Jewish and Muslim traditions, about Abraham being a friend of God. So both of those traditions just really look to the example of Abraham and venerate it in the same spot.
That's definitely something that's, you know, recorded in the Bible. Abraham was a friend of God. I think it's mentioned numerous times. And so this is where it started for him. Well, he was obviously came from Syria region, and then stopped in Shechem first, or Shechem, and then he came down past Jerusalem, broke up with Lot, as you write about in your piece, and then he kind of settles in this area around Hebron. So is there an archaeological side? Obviously there is, we wouldn't be talking about it, but what has been discovered from Abraham's time, things that he might have seen when he came and traveled into Hebron the first time?
Yeah, quite a lot has been discovered, considering that not much of the ancient city has been excavated. Now, the central part of the ancient Hebron is Tel Rumeida. And again, like I say, only part of it has been excavated. It's got a rich history dating all the way back to 3000 BC and slightly before that. But it had a particular height of population in the Middle Bronze period. And that's the period where, to put it simply, in which Abraham lived.
Right. So I think Middle Bronze is like, as far as the dating, traditional dating goes, it's about 2200 to about 1500 BC, something in there. And Abraham would be
right about the middle.
In the middle of that. So if we're looking for artifacts, features, walls from Abraham's time, we're looking inside this window, this rather large window of the Middle Bronze. And you say that this was a period of great building, I guess, in Hebron.
Yeah, exactly. And so large structures have been dated to Abraham's time period, that belong to the population, to the Canaanite Hittite population of that time period. Quite an interesting cuneiform document was found together with these discoveries, and it talks about sheep being sold to Semitic peoples in the land. Now, this is quite interesting for a couple of reasons, one of which, obviously, Abraham was a sheep master. Obviously, Abraham fits the bill of being a Semitic person that was in the land. So we can speculate that perhaps he might have been one of these people who bought sheep from the Hittite, Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And another interesting point is that sheep wasn't so much of a popular thing to farm in Canaan. Usually you would see, in the archaeological record, you would see goats being farmed. Goats are just a whole lot more hardy for the environment, for the dry, hot environment. So it's quite unusual to see sheep being so heavily traded and farmed. So that really fits the description of Abraham being on the scene, and this sheep herder, the early Israelites, as they became known as the Israelites, patriarchs to the early nation of Israel, were sheep herders.
Right, so, Isaac exactly. was, Jacob was. Mm-hmm. I think that even that's the history of Joseph being sent to find his brothers, because they were off in the north of Israel. They were probably off like 100 kilometers away with the sheep. I think they're by Dothan or something like that. Mm. And he's going to search for them. But where is he sent from? If you look back into the book of Genesis, he's sent from Hebron.
From Hebron.
Hebron
right.
as well. So this is a place that is that the patriarchs of Isaac and Jacob and his son. So you've got a period here of 100 years or so, where Hebron's getting a lot of these feet from these leaders stepping all over it.
Right. Really rich history. Really rich history, which explains why there's so much contention today over the city.
Right.
But really rich foundational history there. And it's interesting, it's almost like wherever you see Israelites, you see sheep. It's just a natural thing for Israelites and their forefathers to farm with sheep. So that's quite an interesting nugget to find. But Abraham's first purchase, you could say, of the land of Canaan. I mean, we talk about the Israelites sweeping into the promised land and conquering Canaan. Well, actually, Canaan started to be purchased by their forefather Abraham right from the beginning. And that first ever purchase of land that we know about from the Bible is this series of caves, or at least this main cave that Abraham bought from the leader of Hebron. Now, the Bible discusses this transaction with the leader of Hebron and that it happened in a city gate. Mm-hmm. Now, this was quite a common thing to happen in ancient times. They would conduct transactions in city gates. A lot of legal matters would be decided in a city gate. It was like it was the go-to area, the central area for business to be conducted. I mean, you look at the example of Boaz and Ruth and, right. and his transaction there, his legal settlement of being able to marry Ruth, that happened in a city gate. So the same thing happened in Hebron. And what they've found dating to that same period of Abraham, within the Middle Bronze period there, you've got a massive gatehouse that they found. So again, that helps to color a little bit more the biblical record. For sure. As to perhaps this was the very gatehouse that Abraham went to. And I mean, the city hasn't been excavated that much, but cities don't have numerous gates on them.
Sometimes, a lot of times, they only just have one.
Exactly. The gate is the weak point. So there's a very good chance this could be one of the only, if not the only, gate. So perhaps this was the one that Abraham bought the caves for his family to be buried in.
And they were buried in. I mean, if you go into the generations, Jacob was brought back. He died in Egypt, but he wanted to be buried with his forefathers. He was brought back to this location. And you said at the beginning in your introduction that this cave, we believe we know which cave it was, or this is at least the site that Herod built up this massive compound around those caves. What, in your opinion, what is the likelihood that this is the actual cave?
I think it's quite a good likelihood. I mean, this is known as the oldest prayer structure in continuous prayer structure in the world. So this has a long tradition going back to Herod's time, and that's a lot closer to,
for sure,
to the time period. So people back then may have had more knowledge of the exact location where Abraham was buried. So there's a strong likelihood that was the true location, if it was being revered so much back at that time period, that Herod, for his own vanity's sake, to get the Jews to look to him, he built a massive complex on the site. So there's quite a good chance of this being the site, and traditions of those who have come after the fact and discovered it, elements of the cave that point to it being the exact site. But today, again, it's completely covered over, right, completely renovated, completely walled over. So there's nothing really we can learn of the site as yet.
So maybe we can move forward in the history. We know Abraham was there quite a lot, but it was also a pretty prominent location after the Israelites took back the promised land took the promised land under Joshua and maybe you can talk about that history a bit.
Sure. Well, the archaeological record at Hebron shows that there was some kind of conflagration that happened during that time period that we would expect Joshua to be on the scene. So right during the middle of the second millennium BC, exactly the time that Israel comes in, you have the archaeological record showing this conflagration throughout Canaan, and which would have obviously affected Hebron as well. And just after this time period, you start seeing Israelite settlements popping up in the area. Now, it can be quite easy in some respects to tell what culture you're dealing with based on the way they build houses and such. So the Israelites are no exception with certain building styles like casemate walls, and that's a whole nother story. But long story short, we have Israelite dwellings popping up in this area, and we know from the biblical record that Caleb came in and he took over Hebron, and that was his area. And the city also became one of the cities of refuge, and it was all included under the umbrella of the tribe of Judah. Now, it's quite interesting to read about. when the Israelites came into Canaan, they came up against giants in this area, living in this area of Hebron. And obviously, we haven't found any remains of massive giant skeletons yet, but Hebron, the Hebron of that time that the Israelites would have come against, was made of just massive Cyclopean masonry.
Huge stones.
Massive stones, up to around 10 tons apiece, some of these stones. And this kind of masonry, this kind of stonework, is named after the Greek legendary giants, the Cyclops. And it's just interesting to pair up the records. And, okay, the Bible talks of giants. Maybe they're the ones that built such large Cyclopean masonry. And you have a Cyclopean tower that was built above 20 feet high. I mean, right now it's 20 feet high, the preservation of it, but there was one estimation of it that it went up 60 feet high, this massive tower in the area that the Israelites would have come against. And you think about the spies that went into the Promised Land, they would have seen stuff like this. And maybe this was part of the reason they freaked out and said, we can't conquer this country. And of course, Caleb said, no, we can. Him and Joshua both affirmed that with God with us. This is what we should do. And of course, Caleb was rewarded with this plot of land.
So jumping a little bit ahead of the story from that, probably about, I guess it would be about 500 years or between 400 and 500 years, we have this city, as you said, it was key to the tribe of Judah, actually being one of the capitals, or the capital of the tribe of Judah. And that features heavily into the story of David as well.
Exactly. David, obviously, being of the tribe of Judah, and there's the whole biblical story about David and Saul, and David being crowned king. In God's eyes, he was king, but Saul remained on the throne for a while before he was killed by the Philistines, and David became king. Now, from the beginning, David was recognized as rightful king only by the tribe of Judah. So they made him king in Hebron. That was his capital city to begin with. For the first 7 years, he was king in Hebron before the rest of the Israelites came along and also recognized him as king. So it's quite interesting in the archaeological record of Tel Rameda, of Hebron, that during the lead up to that period, the time of the judges, there was Israelite settlements, but it was just kind of a more of a sparse population. But then the city really ramps up in prominence and growth right at the time that David's on the scene.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about Hebron as being the capital of David's kingdom, at least for a period. 7 years, it's a long time. While Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, was king for a while up in kind of over Israel, and then he died, and then you had, you know, they were fighting amongst themselves. And then finally, you have the northern tribes coming to David and saying, okay, we're ready. Can you be king over us now? It's been a while. We're done with this, you know, infighting. Let's become one single nation again. And where do they come? They come in 2 Samuel 5. It talks about them coming down to Hebron to meet David there. And then from there, David takes Jerusalem. So this city, I mean, has got a lot of rich history. There's a lot more to it, but we are out of time. But don't fear, because Chris is writing this article, and it'll be up on the website, and you can go ahead and click on it and read the rest of the details related to the significance of this city as far as the archaeological record goes and the Bible. Thank you very much, Chris, for filling us in about this city, and also just for talking to us about the ins and outs of archaeological work in Hebrew University. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening to the show. If you'd like to send some feedback, please go ahead and send those emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thank you again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.